It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Some people love it, some hate it. I'm talking about lamb. Now, is there a reason lamb tastes like lamb?
There is a big reason why lamb tastes like lamb, and it is a very distinctive taste. It's one that we all recognize. It's one that some people love and some people really, really don't love. But what it all comes down to is it's fat and a particular type of fatty acid. It's called a branched-chain fatty acid. And this is something that humans can detect at tiny levels. And it's what gives lamb this kind of gamey, more earthy taste than, say, beef.
Another lesson in cook science with Molly Birnbaum of America's Test Kitchen. And lots more this hour on The Splendid Table.
Hi, it's Francis Lamb, the new host of The Splendid Table. I'm looking forward to being with you in a new show on March 24th, right here on this public radio station. But until then, here's this week's show with Lynn.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Most of us have food issues. We eat too much of what we shouldn't and not enough of what we should, or maybe we eat in cycles, as in not letting a morsel of the quote-unquote bad stuff pass through our lips. And then we indulge with a hefty portion of guilt on the side. Well, in looking for answers to why we have these difficult relationships with food, British food historian Bea Wilson turned to the science behind why we like to eat what we like to eat. And what she learned is in her new book, First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. Well, Bea spoke with our contributor, Joe Yonan. He is food and dining editor of The Washington Post.
Bea, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So why do you think so many of us seem to have such a difficult relationship with food?
Well, I think it's partly because we have this mistaken idea that eating is something really simple, that it's just innate, like breathing, that we're born knowing how to do it. And actually, it's a series of immensely complicated skills that some of us master better than others. But I think another reason is there are just so many ways in which eating can go wrong, and I hadn't even fully appreciated before I wrote the book the extent to which there's this spectrum of unhappy and disordered eating, ranging from anorexia on the one hand, to yo-yo dieters, to binge eaters, to adult picky eaters. And it's tied up with so much of the rest of life. And part of my starting point for the book was that I myself used to be really unhappy and out of control in the way that I ate as a teenager and a young adult. And now I feel I've jumped over to a really happy place with food. I don't associate it with guilt. I don't beat myself up over things that I eat. And the book was really my attempt to explain how this was possible. How can someone change from a fraught relationship with food to a less fraught one, which is, after all, where we all want to get?
How did that work for you? How did you change your relationship with food?
It's really strange looking back to try and work out how it happened, because it definitely didn't happen in the way that all of the diets I used to impose on myself did. You know, as a teenager, when I was unhappy about eating, I was endlessly forcing myself on these punitive diets, and I'd feel really hungry, and I'd be hopeful at first, and then I'd kind of give up and cave in after about 3 or 4 days, and then I'd feel even worse. Whereas when I changed to this new way of eating, first of all, it took time. Secondly, I think it was bound up with lots of other things going on in my life. The big thing was that I fell in love with the person who was my future husband, who had a completely different relationship with food. It wasn't that he was a health nut, far from it, but it was just that he was eating 3 structured meals a day. He didn't seem to have food in these different moral categories in the way that I had done. A slice of cake was just a slice of cake, but equally, he ate salad because he loved it. And that really changed my perspective on food.
What's so fascinating is this idea that you learned that eating is something that we learn to do in a very specific way, and that it's not something that we're just born with. Can you talk a little bit more about how you came to that and what that means?
Yes. I mean, this was a big revelation I had while I was doing the research. I didn't really realize that was the theme of the book. I thought I was writing a book when I started about children and food. But the more I looked at it, the more I saw that the ways in which children were learning to eat were still there for adults, and that many of us as adults haven't, in fact, successfully learned the eating skills that we need in order to feed ourselves in a way that's nutritionally pretty balanced and also a pleasure. And I don't think it's how we think of eating. We think of our likes and dislikes as something which is so intimate and personal that surely they must be nature rather than nurture. They must be something genetic, because they seem to follow us around like a comforting shadow. You know, our love of cauliflower and our hatred of grapes or whatever it might be seem to tell us who we are. But the more I looked into the science of it, the more it became clear that almost all of our likes and dislikes are in fact a function of memory in the brain. You know, we're imprinted with certain flavor memories from the very first taste that we take, but also environment, the cues that we're picking up from our culture, from our parents and the rest of our family about what's good to eat.
One of my favorite parts of your book was about the Clara Davis experiments. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, this was an extraordinary thing. She would never have got away with it now because it would be seen, rightly, as completely unethical. So Clara Davis was a pediatrician from Chicago, and she took a group of children who'd never had a bite of solid food. Some of them were orphans, and some of them had single mothers. And she put them in an experimental orphanage in a hospital. And her idea was, what would children's tastes look like if they were freed up from all of the usual influences and expectations? And she offered the children each day a smorgasbord of different foods. There was beets, there was peaches, lettuce, beef, chicken, bone broth, liver, salt. And there was no expectation they should eat this or that. They weren't pushed to any food. And at the end of the experiment, what she found was that each of the children had a different pattern of tastes, but each of them was able to select for themselves a diet which served them very well nutritionally. There were children who, at the time they entered the hospital, had rickets. They cured themselves. The ones who were malnourished were no longer malnourished. So the way that people have often taken this experiment is to say, great, we can just leave children alone to their own devices. There's this phrase that doctors used a lot in the middle of the 20th century, wisdom of the body. We just naturally know what to eat. And actually, Dr. Davis drew the opposite conclusion. She was aware that the biggest thing she'd done with her experiment was to radically restructure the children's environment. Of course, if we were all choosing from a diet of nothing but pure, whole, unprocessed foods, our likes and dislikes wouldn't matter so much. But in a society where a child has a choice between, do you want this sugary cereal or do you want this sugary sports bar, being left to their own devices isn't such a great idea. And Dr. Davis concluded that actually children's nutrition should be left in the hands of their elders where it's always belonged.
That led you to come up with some interesting conclusions about what might work best for parents of so-called selective eaters or picky eaters.
I was so pleased by this research because it's so hopeful. There is lots that parents of picky eaters can do. And I'm not saying it's equally easy for everyone. I think sometimes there's a kind of element of judgment that comes in. If you have children who are relatively easy to feed, you might look at another family and think, why won't their children just eat and they must be doing something wrong? And actually, it's really hard for a lot of parents. But there is a lot of recent research that's been done just over the past 10 years, both by academic researchers and by clinicians, which shows that you can really change a child's whole relationship with food. So I spoke to the director of Feeding Clinic, Keith Williams, in Pennsylvania, who works with children on the autistic spectrum, some of whom are down to eating just three foods. There was a boy he worked with who ate nothing but hot dogs, grilled cheese sandwiches, and milk. And you can't get the nutrition you need from that. And it's miserable for the whole family. Some of the kids he works with, it gets so bad they're being fed by a tube. And he found that if you could just expose the children to a range of foods that were the size of a grain of rice, they would consent to put that food in their mouth. And what we know is that because our likes are largely a function of exposure, if you can try that grain of rice-sized piece of food often enough, the odds are you're going to like it. And he did this amazing experiment where he succeeded in converting these two very, very resistant toddlers who had been on three foods up to as many as 65 new foods in their repertoire over just 2 weeks. It really works.
Bee, thank you so much. The book is fascinating, and I really appreciate your talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Bee Wilson is author of First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. Joe Yonan is author of Eat Your Vegetables, Bold Recipes for the Single Cook. And with those vegetables in mind, Joe left us with a recipe for a grilled greens chickpea and peppadew sandwich. And you can find it at splendidtable.org. Nearly everyone in the world eats lamb, except for Americans. We average 11 pounds of lamb per person per year, compared to 65 pounds of beef. Now, part of the reason for those low consumption numbers undoubtedly is the distinctive taste. You either love it or you hate it. As part of our new ongoing partnership with America's Test Kitchen, our managing producer, Sally Swift, sat down with Molly Birnbaum, the executive editor of Cook Science from America's Test Kitchen, for another of our monthly lessons in cooking fundamentals. This time, they delved into the question, why does lamb taste like lamb?
Hey, Molly, good to have you back.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we are in lamb season, if ever there is a lamb season in the United States.
We are indeed.
Is there a reason that lamb tastes like lamb?
There is a big reason why lamb tastes like lamb, and it is a very distinctive taste. It's one that we all recognize. It's one that some people love and some people really, really don't love. But what it all comes down to is its fat and a particular type of fatty acid that lambs have that beef doesn't. And it's called a branched-chain fatty acid. And this is something that humans can detect at tiny levels. And it's what gives lamb this kind of gamey, more earthy taste than, say, beef.
Huh. And I want to back up a minute because lamb tastes very different to me. The New Zealand lamb that I eat, which is pretty much all we can find, I find it very hard to find American lamb. Is there a difference in taste between the two of them?
There is. There's a huge difference in taste between domestic lamb and most of our imported lamb, which is from New Zealand or Australia. And what it comes down to is the diet of the lamb.
Which would influence that fat.
Yeah, it influences so much, especially their fat. But New Zealand lamb is all pasture-raised, so they're farmed on grass. They eat grass for their whole life. And that really brings out these branched-chain fatty acids in their fat. So they're, you know, pretty strong tasting. They taste like lamb. They're lambs that taste like lamb.
Right.
And they're a little bit less fatty as well. And then the domestic lamb, the American lamb, is a little bit milder. And this is so much because American lambs are often finished on grain. For the last 30 days of their life, they eat grain. So they eat grass until then. But this change in their diet changes the type and amount of fat that they have. So they have less of these branched-chain fatty acids and therefore less of that super distinctive lamb flavor.
So is there a way to control that flavor if you get rid of the fat? There's not much fat on a piece of lamb for the most part.
It depends on the cut, but the best way to control the flavor if you are eating lamb but don't want it to taste too lamby, take off as much fat as you can. A lot of cuts have, you know, a fat cap that you can trim down.
Right.
One of my favorite cuts is the leg of lamb, which I like to have butterflied, and that cut also allows you to kind of get in there and take out the little pockets of fat that are in there. And so, yeah, taking out the fat is what can control the lamb flavor.
Okay, and what is your favorite way for preparing, let's say, a butterflied leg of lamb?
Well, we have a recipe that is really nice. My family actually made it for Christmas this year. It's a leg of lamb, boneless, butterflied, so it's opened up and easier to season all over, kind of easier to take out this fat and make it evenly spaced. And we cook it low and slow to start, which helps kind of break down
the
collagen.
And you roasted it, not on the grill.
Yes, this is a roasted butterflied leg of lamb, and we start it at a 250-degree oven, cook it nice and slow. It really helps to break down the tougher parts of the meat. The salt is in there, so it's super flavorful. We have an oil that's flavored with lots of spices and some lemon peel and ginger and shallots. And then when it reaches about 120 degrees, we broil it. So then it gets a nice crispy top to it just for a few
Sounds
minutes.
Delicious. And do you marinate? Does lamb take well to marinades and rubs, or is that a wasted step?
It does. We marinate or rub a lot of different lamb. It's such a distinctive flavor that it pairs well with kind of nice, strong spices and as well as herbs, coriander, fennel, garlic, shallot, ginger, lemon peel. I think those work really nicely with lamb. There are other herbs that are traditionally paired with lamb, too.
Like mint.
In England especially, lamb and mint is a huge thing.
Lamb and bad mint jelly, to be frank.
Exactly. And there is a little bit of science behind that. There has been a lot of talk in recent years about flavor pairings and how different foods, even if they seem a little bit incongruous, would work together flavor-wise because they share some flavor compounds or some elements of some flavor compounds, such as chocolate and blue cheese, for example. And there have been a few papers about this out there and a few startup businesses whose goal is to help chefs pair these types of foods together.
Not to mention selling books.
Exactly. But there is a little bit of overlap in the flavor of mint and in the flavor of lamb, especially these branched-chain fatty acids that are making up kind of the gamey flavor. So when you really deep dive into it, there is a reason why lamb and mint go together.
Molly, that's so interesting. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Molly Birnbaum is the executive editor of Cook Science from America's Test Kitchen. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Molly picked out a lamb recipe sure to please everybody. You can find roast butterflied leg of lamb with coriander, cumin, and mustard seed at splendidtable.org. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Let's say you could drop into one of Rome's hotspot eateries right now. Well, where do you imagine you'd be? I bet it's not a speakeasy. Yet read Katie Parla's new book. She's a journalist who's been tracking the Roman food scene for years, and you'll realize Rome's hallowed Cucina Tipica is heading into new territory. Katie is co-author with Christina Gill of Tasting Rome, Fresh Flavors and Forgotten Recipes from an Ancient City. Our contributor Rebecca Shear talked with Parla about why she thinks Italian food needn't be super traditional in order to be super authentic.
Katie Parla, thank you so much for talking with me today.
It's a pleasure.
Now, Katie, you've spent so much time in Rome, learning about Roman food, preparing Roman food, and of course, eating Roman food. So for those of us who haven't done all those things, what is Roman food? How would you characterize it?
So it's definitely a set of dishes, Jewish and non, that sort of reflect the geography and the territory of Rome and its environs. It's salt-driven, it's pecorino-laced. Pecorino is a really salty sheep's milk cheese. It's pasta and offal and vegetable-based. And it's a cuisine that can still be found on home and restaurant tables, though I would note that it is evolving, like all cuisines. And some things that were perhaps the cornerstones of the local table even a few decades ago are losing prominence as the city's cuisine develops.
Give us an example or two.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things that I really love sort of exploring because there are so many dishes that even like 10 years ago would have been protagonists in a sort of traditional Roman meal. And for a variety of economic reasons, for convenience reasons, the way that people eat has changed. And there are things like skate and broccoli soup, a labor-intensive soup often consumed on Fridays that is on the verge of vanishing from the local table. So there are only a couple of places that I can even think of in Rome that make garofalato, which is this sort of pot roast that's simmered with tomato and cloves. It's super spiced. Even simmered beef, like beef brisket, really deeply simmered meats to break down meat so it's super tender. Those used to be heavily featured on menus. But, you know, the availability of products, whether it's vegetables from all over the world or, you know, meat cuts that previously were inaccessible are now cheap and easy to get. So that's in some ways sort of diluted the local cuisine, although I would say that there still is a cucina romana or a classic Roman cuisine that survives in some places.
And it's being more or less retooled as the years go by, it sounds like.
I mean, as people's dining habits change, it has to, in order to survive, it has to be sort of tweaked for the contemporary palate and the contemporary wallet. So, like, one of my favorite places to eat in Rome is this little stall in the Testaccio Market. And even just, like, 3 years ago, you couldn't go and get a really delicious sandwich at a market. You went to the market for raw materials. But now as people start going more to supermarkets, some market vendors have sort of transitioned their butcher's licenses into food service licenses. So there's a place called Mordiavai, and you go and get Roman main courses, whether it's simmered brisket or tripe or tongue on a sandwich. What they're doing is they're giving you a super economical, like very convenient Roman dish in portable form that otherwise you would have to sit down at a restaurant and spend, you know, upwards of 15 euros and an hour to consume. So it's just more relevant for sort of modern Roman.
Well, your book does such a great job of combining the old and the new. And one of the older dishes you include is carbonara, which, as you point out, doesn't have an original recipe. In fact, I love how you write, I'm going to quote you here, "Bring up the subject of carbonara with a Roman and suggest an ingredient or technique that diverges from his or her own, and you've got a passionate fight on your hands." Given that, how did you decide which recipe to include in the book?
Well, after a lot of really heavy carbonara research, I decided that Flavio De Mayo's carbonara is sort of the best expression of this Roman dish. He uses a lot of guanciale. He uses whole eggs. He uses a mixture of pecorino and Parmigiano-Reggiano. And he cooks it all in a hot, hot aluminum pan in the classic Roman style. He has this like enormous warped aluminum pan, sort of swirls the whole egg mixture in the pan until it coats the pasta and forms almost like a zabaglione. And I thought that that was a dish that could be recreated in the American or some non-Roman kitchen and still really preserve like the flavors and the continuity of that dish.
In terms of newer foods and dishes in this ever-evolving cuisine, you include a recipe for pizza al contrario, or upside-down pizza. Tell us about that.
There is this incredible baker and pizza maker called Gabriele Bonci, and sometimes he makes pizza, rather than your sort of classic pizza by the slice. He'll spread the toppings on a sheet pan, liberally coat them with olive oil, season them, and then put the raw dough on top, and then bake everything in the oven so the sort of toppings are on the bottom, and they aromatize the dough from below. So he'll use like lots of herbs and onions and or even sausage, so that when you take the pizza out of the oven and let it cool and slice it up and sort of flip it over, you have this sort of rich, deep flavor that has infused the dough. It's wonderful.
So when you eat it, you actually flip it back over so the crust is on the bottom.
Exactly.
Ah. Now, Roman cuisine goes back thousands of years, and through the years, we saw the rise of a really interesting hybrid, Roman-Jewish cuisine. And you include a number of Roman-Jewish recipes in the book, spicy fish with couscous, honey-soaked matzo fritters. How is it that this Jewish community, which makes up 0.3% of the city's population today, how is it that it's so predominant right now with its food culture?
Well, I think that Romans are, regardless of their background, are really super interested in authenticity. And of the 4.3 million people in Rome today, you'd be hard-pressed to find any community within that, aside from the Jewish community, that can sort of really claim to be descended from people of the Roman Republic or the Empire. There have been Jews in Rome for 22 centuries. There's a specific Jewish rite that's practiced here, which is unique in the world. It's not Sephardic or Ashkenazic. It is Roman. And so I think for that reason, people want to taste these authentic flavors. And the Jewish quarter, which is called the Jewish ghetto, occupies this area that for 300 years, Roman Jews were confined to a walled, squalid ghetto space. And a unique cuisine emerged from those conditions of poverty and still persists on tables at homes and restaurants and can be enjoyed in the Jewish quarter. And so it's become a point of reference, not just for Jewish visitors, but for Italians who come from all over Italy to visit Rome, for foreigners from all over the world. And they're especially interested, I think, in like the deep-fried artichoke, which is called Carciofi alla Giudia, Jewish style. And there's now, I think, a super fascinating facet of the Roman Jewish cuisine, which is a Libyan Jewish cuisine, which is a recent arrival to the city. In 1967, thousands of Jews escaped from Benghazi and Tripoli and were welcomed in Rome and lived here as refugees. Some went to Israel, some stayed. And many are involved in food service in the Jewish quarter and sell couscous with spicy fish stew or shakshuka, things that really evoke North African flavors, side by side with the classic Roman Jewish dishes, concha, which is fried marinated zucchini, anchovy and endive casserole, and of course the twice-fried artichoke.
Well, Katie Parla, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
It was my pleasure.
Katie Parla is co-author with Christina Gill of Tasting Rome. Rebecca Shear is a reporter based in Washington, D.C. Now, Katie left us with a recipe for the simple and delicious Roman classic, cacio e pepe. Essentially, good cheese, that's pecorino romano, peppercorns, and good pasta. Her version is called Cacio e Pepe di Leonardo Vignoli, and you can find it at splendidtable.org. Oh, and while you're there, be sure to check out our information page about our new host, Frances Lamb, who will be taking over in earnest at the end of the year. We are really excited. Now, you'll find it all at splendidtable.org. I have some information that could blow play dates right out of the water, and it involves those healthy microbes that we can't seem to stop talking about right now. A pediatric neurologist claims our kids aren't dirty enough. Dr. Maya Shatrid Klein, mother of three, by the way, says our kids should get good and dirty, play outside, roll around in the grass and the dirt, get into Mother Nature. And they should get Mother Nature inside by eating foods from healthy soil, too. She's essentially challenging our ideas of what's sanitary and healthy for our kids. New York Times food columnist Melissa Clark talked with Dr. Shatrid Klein about the research behind her conclusions in her book, The Dirt Cure, Growing Healthy Kids with Food Straight from the Soil.
Maya, welcome.
Thank you so much.
What do you mean by the dirt cure? What are you curing?
Well, I'll first say what I mean by dirt. So dirt is being exposed to microbes. It's eating fresh, unprocessed food from healthy soil. And it's getting outdoors in nature. And I use the word cure very rarely in my life because I'm not someone who really believes in, you know, miracles just as such. And I think really healing is a journey. But I think curing is about curing this idea, essentially, which is that we think we need to be really sanitized. We think we can control everything in nature. And really what I think is that we've gotten a lot sicker. The more we try to control things, the sicker, particularly children, have become. And now we're seeing many, many children chronically ill with allergies, asthma, ADHD, all kinds of autoimmune conditions. So I think it's really about curing a way of thinking and an approach.
And so when you tell us that our children need to go outside and play in the dirt, how does that connect to helping them get better?
Well, it's funny because I think most of us think, you know, yeah, getting outside is totally nice, totally healthy. It turns out there's a tremendous amount of science that actually supports that. So for one thing, being outside in the sunshine reduces the risk of developing nearsightedness in children. And it has to do with being actually in natural light. You know, there's a bunch of studies actually looking at soil microbes. And in one teaspoon of soil, there are as many microbes as there are people on the planet. And there are certain microbes that have actually been shown to boost serotonin levels as high as antidepressants.
Oh, wow.
And so children or adults, when we're outdoors, we actually are happier and we are able to be less stressed and perform better on tests. Children who are outdoors actually perform better on standardized tests when they've been in natural environments versus being in less natural environments.
And now to connect this to food, so you don't want us to just be dirty on the outside. You want us to bring it inside too. For example, not scrubbing our vegetables or peeling them. And talk a little bit about that, about how we can bring the dirt within.
Absolutely. So part of what we've done in this whole sanitizing of not being outside and sanitizing our homes and hand sanitizer and all of those things has been also to sanitize food. So how we're growing food, you know, we're using pesticides in many cases and chemical fertilizers and, you know, washing things with chlorine and things like that. And we're actually not getting exposed to the kind of microbes that we want to be exposed to from soil. In addition, that rich, healthy soil is actually infused into our food. And that makes the food healthier. It makes the plants healthier, actually. It makes the animals who eat the plants healthier. And we, who eat animals and plants, are also healthier because our soil's healthy.
Yeah, one of the great things that you say in your book is, we are what we eat eats, right. Which I think sums that up. When we're shopping and when we're looking for food, is it important to buy organic food necessarily, or is local more important?
This is, you know, one of those conundrums that I think everyone feels like they get embroiled in if they're really being mindful about this. And I think, you know, we need to walk into it doing the best we can. So I think it's always best. I mean, if you can grow your own or even grow a little bit of your own, that's wonderful. I think going to farmers markets and knowing who produced your food and how it's produced and getting the freshest food possible is incredibly important. And then I think obviously eating organic, because we know in a lot of different studies that traces of pesticides do remain on food, we do want to avoid that. And I think particularly for certain foods, I always look at environmental working groups, Dirty Dozen, as kind of a guide for the top foods to avoid. And then animal products as much as possible. The thick-skinned fruits and vegetables or the clean 15 are the ones, you know, I'm a little more flexible about.
If you were going to advise people to make one change in their diets, what would it be?
You know, we've become a very sugar-obsessed society, and part of that is we've evolved to eat more and more sweets, and also food industry has added a lot more sugar. But actually, what I'd recommend is to eat bitters, because bitters, which could be the peel of fruits and vegetables, it can be dark chocolate, it can be even coffee, beer, all contain bitters. A lot of the food, you know, leafy greens, broccoli rabe, all of those foods actually contain these alkaloid compounds that go into our body and stimulate our digestion. So we make more stomach acid, we digest better, our detoxification mechanisms increase, and our immune systems all over our body, including our ear, nose, and throat, actually are boosted. So I'm a big, big fan of bitters. I actually even take a little bitter tonic before I eat meals.
What's in your bitter tonic?
It has chamomile, it has angelica, it has all kinds of herbs in it, actually, and it's just like a little spray bottle. And I actually recommend it to kids, to patients, to help their digestion. And surprisingly, even really picky kids will do the bitters.
Fascinating. Thank you so much for talking with us. This was great. I learned so much.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Maya Shetreat-Klein is the author of The Dirt Cure. Melissa Clark's new book is Dinner, Changing the Game. Now, get outside and get down and dirty with this recipe for hot spiced portobello grill with fresh arugula and Parmigiano shavings. And you can find it at splendidtable.org. Coming up, your questions. And have you ever thought about what it would be like to go out to dinner in a wheelchair? Well, we have a perspective from Dan Pashman, host of the podcast The Sporkful. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It is time to turn to your calls. Let's connect any way we can. Facebook, Twitter, or actually pick up the phone. 800-537-5252. We have Jack on the line from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Jack, this is really a long-distance call.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm a huge fan. I listen to your show all the time and have been for many years.
Well, it's good to have you. Are you there in the military or are you working in another area?
I work in the defense sector for an American company out here for a few years, so I get to know the culture and the great food that they've got out here. So it's never a dull moment in Saudi Arabia.
I can imagine. I envy you. But you probably called with a question.
Yes, ma'am, I did. I have a question for you about camel. In Saudi Arabia, I'm sure you know that camel is sort of their version of cattle, and it's pretty ubiquitous in the grocery stores. You find it right next to veal and beef and things like that.
Right.
And St. Patrick's Day, I was getting ready to do my typical corned beef brisket, and when I was going down to actually get a breakfast, a traditional Saudi breakfast of a camel liver fried up with onions, which is delicious, but right next door to the place where they have this thing called kibda hashi are camel butcheries. And it occurred to me, why not try corned camel instead of corned beef?
That makes a lot of sense.
Well, it sort of makes sense to me, but my question for you is, I'm not familiar with what I should look for in a cut in the camel. And is there anything particular that I should do in corning it that I would or wouldn't do with a corned beef brisket?
I think that the key here is that, first of all, you want the piece of meat to be about the same thickness, because that's going to determine how quickly the cure that you use to do corned beef is going to penetrate. You know, so if you have a really big piece of meat, it's going to take much more time. And, you know, usually when you corn something, you're corning something like the brisket, right? I mean, it's a tough cut. And I think it could come from almost anywhere on the animal. You know, I'll bet you that the anatomy of a camel, well, it's obviously very similar to the anatomy of a lot of other meat animals, where the top of the animal is probably where the most tender meat comes from. And one thing I wonder, now that, do you speak the language? Can you communicate with the people in the butcher shop?
Yes, ma'am. My Arabic is passable, and I've also got access to some old Saudi hands, the people who introduced me to the traditional camel over breakfast, so I could bring them along with me to the butcher shop.
All right. What you want to ask is, what cuts of meat would you stew? And explain that, because I have no doubt camel is preserved in different ways. I mean, it must be salted or cured in some way. It's a big animal. I mean, when you butcher a camel, you got to fight in the heat especially. And I would ask, what would they suggest? And the other thing I think that would be kind of great to do is see if there's a tiny bit of marbling. I'm not sure how lean camel is. I've only had camel burgers. And it was very hard with the sauce on them and whatever. It was really hard to discern what it tasted like. But, you know, it didn't taste odd. It just, I would have loved to have had a camel steak, you know, to really know what it was like.
Okay. Well, I've done camel steak before. And we had a guy working with us. He was an older gentleman. He was 75 years old. And he made the comment that it tasted like steak used to.
Yeah. I'd get a couple. I'd get two, and I'd experiment two different kinds of cures, because I think it could really be delicious. Give it a shot. I think this could be really exciting.
I will report back, and I'll keep you informed.
Thanks, Jack. Take care.
Thank you, ma'am. Bye-bye.
We've got Sharon calling from Phoenix. Hey, Sharon, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thank you for taking my call.
You are welcome.
A few years ago, my husband got tired of pilfering rosemary from a neighbor's yard when I needed it for a recipe. And so he planted one in our yard, and it has grown to enormous proportions. And I have used it for things like sauces and poultry, and also as a topping for focaccia. But I'm just wondering if there are other things that I can do with this lovely rosemary.
Oh, you know, it's wonderful in spice cakes, like gingerbread and lemon. Anything you make with lemon. You know, a pudding, a lemon poppy seed muffin, even a little bit in lemonade. It's really good. Really good. The other thing is that I'm trying. Now, rosemary, you know how powerful it is. If you overdo it, you really overdo it, and it's not very good. It generally works with almost any meat, lamb, pork, a lot of game, chicken, and fish, too, in small quantities with more delicate fish. But with things like salmon, you puree together garlic, a bit of olive oil, and a bit of rosemary. And when you're done grilling the salmon or any other fish, you just take it to the table and drizzle that over it with a squeeze of fresh lemon. Now, that's not using huge quantities of it, but there's something else you should know. It freezes brilliantly right on the branch.
Wow.
Yeah. I buy it in the market, and I often get a plant. I live in a place where it doesn't generally make it through the winter. But I just trim it. I wash it, let it drain completely so it gets dry. You know, you don't want it to be wet when it goes into your bag. And then you take one of those plastic bags where you can press all the air out. Mm-hmm. I write the year and what it is, and it goes into the freezer.
That's a beautiful idea.
Yeah, so that plant can be your harvest every year. Mm-hmm. Now, there will be a point when you will be giving gifts of rosemary, because nobody's going to use all of that. But the other thing is, you know, it's beautiful, and you can bring it as a hostess gift or decorate a package with it, is a big bouquet of it, tied with a pale blue ribbon, maybe mixed with other flowers like daffodils, tulips. You know, cut as long branches of it and use it as a centerpiece. Use it as a decoration. Rosemary was one of the great wedding favors that a bride would hand out. You know how at weddings often you would get candies or that kind of thing, a little package? Mm-hmm. Well, it's the herb of fond remembrance. And the idea is the bride would give sprigs of rosemary or bouquets of rosemary so that the guests would remember her day fondly.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. So
I'm going to try that.
Yeah. It's lovely. It's really a lovely idea. So I see you now. That bush is going to be down to about a foot off the ground. Enjoy.
Well, thank you.
You are welcome. Enjoy the rosemary, Sharon.
Thank you so much.
You take care.
Thank you.
Bye. We have Kate calling from Austin, Texas. Hey, Kate, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. So I'm calling because my mother just got back from Morocco and she bought me fresh vanilla beans.
Oh, fresh vanilla beans.
Yes.
A lot of
them? And I was
wondering,
no, well, she only let me take some of them, not all of them.
I understand.
Right. So I was wondering what to make with them and also what's the best way to keep them fresh.
What I do with them generally is I make sure they're absolutely airtight, but I lay them out flat in a freezer bag, press out all the air, and then I freeze them because I can pull out one at a time.
Right.
Now, one of the things that you can do, classic thing to do with vanilla beans, is to cut one in half and stick it in a bowl of sugar.
Okay.
And you've got vanilla sugar. By the way, you can reuse vanilla beans. So you cook it in a custard, you know, or your hot chocolate, right? And you take the bean and you maybe even split it and you stick it as you're making the hot chocolate. When you're done, you pull out the bean, you wash it, you dry it, and you can use it again. So that's the other thing. Yeah. Now let's have some fun. Vanilla, butter, and lemon. Melted butter with vanilla bean warmed in it. And then finished with salt and a bit of lemon juice, you put that over almost anything. You put that over something like a little redskin potato that you've baked and you open up and you put that butter, vanilla butter in it. It's just fabulous. On sweet potatoes, you will die with pleasure. And you put that on almost any seafood and it's wonderful. So that's one place where vanilla works. Vanilla also works, believe it or not, with hot flavors. You could take vanilla and you could take fresh jalapeno chili and you take, again, something acidic with it and let that be a marinade that you use for, well, let's say, something like chicken thighs or a piece of sole or, you know, a fillet of almost anything. You know where vanilla is really wonderful? If you ever make pumpkin pie with all the spices, give it a healthy slug of vanilla. It just mellows the whole thing. It just makes it, I don't know, more sensual. Now, let me think. I think I'm running out of ideas here.
The butter sounds awesome.
The butter really is. And one thing I've never tried, but I always thought it would be fun to do, is to do sort of a vanilla dressing for fruit, you know, to do a fruit salad, but where you do the vanilla with a little bit of vinegar. You scrape the beans into a mild vinegar, you know, like an Asian rice vinegar. That tends to be a very gentle vinegar. And then a bit of sugar as well. So you make a sweet sour dressing and then toss that with fresh fruit. That could be really wonderful too. I think this will launch you with the vanilla beans. And if you play it right, you'll still have some in 10 years.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I might have to make a lot of that butter. I think a lot of my friends would be pretty interested.
It freezes. It can freeze. So,
all
hey,
right,
thanks
awesome.
For a great question, Kate.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You take care.
All right.
Bye. Now you can get to us, 800-537-5252. Even if you've never experienced a wheelchair, you can probably surmise the basic challenges of dining out in public. While stairs and restrooms are pretty obvious, there are finer points to dining out with a disability, ones that are more complicated and more personal. Dan Pashman, host of the podcast The Sporkful at WNYC, decided to dig into the issue firsthand, and he joins us now. Hey, Dan, good to have you with us.
Hi, Lynn. Great to be here.
So, Dan, tell me how you went about getting this story.
Well, it first occurred to me, I was out to eat, and I was at this restaurant where the chairs had arms, but the arms didn't really fit underneath the table. And so I couldn't get as close to the table as I wanted to get to feel comfortable, to eat comfortably. And, you know, I'm always kind of obsessing about these details of eating. That's kind of what we do on The Sporkful a lot. And it occurred to me, like, if I was in a wheelchair, this could be an issue I would run into all the time. So I wanted to go out to eat with a couple of people in wheelchairs and learn about some of those, the bigger and smaller issues that might not be obvious to me or any of us who aren't in wheelchairs, what it's like for them to go out to eat. So I went out with John Hockenberry. He's the host of The Takeaway public radio show, and a gentleman named David Friedman, who is a special ed teacher by day and a blogger by night. He writes this blog called The Disabled Foodie, where he reviews restaurants both on the food and on the accessibility. So I went out with them, and I asked David what he thinks is the most important thing to understand about people dining out in a wheelchair.
How does the staff react to a person with disabilities? The other evening, it was right out of a cartoon. You know, the scene in the cartoon where everybody's confused and they all run into each other with the, what do I do? What do I do? And they didn't know what to do with me. They treated me like I was from Mars. They didn't even offer to help because they were so confused. And that's all it would have taken was, what can we do? How can we help? And there was, throughout the whole evening, there was none of that. And then they had told my friend that the restaurant was accessible. At the end of the meal, I said, where's the bathroom? Oh, it's downstairs.
Like, I would want to check bathroom accessibility when I walk in the door because it would affect how much I was going to drink, because I wouldn't want to have to pee and then find out that I can't make it to the bathroom.
I think on some level, you know, the whole bathroom thing is partly my responsibility. I mean, I kind of have to, you know, be aware of, you know, what my needs are going to be. And it is happens to be the case. I mean, if you're spinal cord injured, if you suddenly have to go to the bathroom in the middle of a sentence, it's a major deal, but it's not the hugest issue for me, because for me, the question is, do they treat you like anybody else in the restaurant? And there are restaurants that do. And I tell you, my favorite place in the world is Il Molino in Manhattan. They got three steps in there. I just knock on the window. They come out. They get me. They put me in. It's not accessible. I wish they'd get a ramp, but you know what? The way they treat me, it just totally compensates for it. And when I'm in the restaurant, I mean, I could be Frank Sinatra.
So it sounds like a place could have full accessibility. They could have ramps. They could have everything. And if they're a bunch of jerks, well, that doesn't do
much
good.
Yeah.
That hurts.
Yeah, that does hurt.
But I call ahead is my process. And over time, I've learned what questions to ask. Just asking, is the restaurant accessible? A lot of the time, what I've found is the staff may not know what that actually means or what that looks like, so they'll tell you yes because they're coming from the place of, well, I was able to get in.
Or they just have seen someone in a wheelchair in the
right
restaurant and they just don't think about what it took to get in there.
So I ask specific questions about, is the bathroom accessible? Are there grab bars around the toilet? And if it comes down to it, I ask, are the doorways 34 inches or wider?
A single step is invisible to people. You really do have to say things like, how many steps are there to get into your restaurant?
I'm curious to ask, and I'm sort of, you know, playing devil's advocate here a little bit, and David, in particular, because you're a special ed teacher, I'm sure you have a level of expertise with a wide range of different types of disabilities.
Yeah.
Is there a certain type of disability or level of disability in a certain situation in a restaurant where if the restaurant said, you know, we can't serve you here, we can't accommodate you here, is there any level or any situation where you feel like that would be okay with you, that you would understand where the restaurant was coming from?
You're really playing devil's advocate with me, because my answer is no. By law, they have to be able to accommodate, and you've got me in the frame of mind of thinking about my students. And if anyone refused them, I would be really angry. Because there's no reason. A person is a person is a person. A need is a need is a need. And one of the things that was said to me recently that really resonated is that everybody will be disabled, be it permanently or temporarily, at some point in their lifetime. Be it you're on crutches because you broke a leg or what have you.
You know, that's what we rarely think about. And we're all going to experience it in one way or another. Dan, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you, Lynn.
Dan Pashman is host of The Sporkful, a podcast from WNYC Studios. And by the way, we're taking on the podcast challenge this month. Here's the idea. Tell a friend about a podcast you think they're going to love. And if they don't already use podcasts, show them how to do it. Tell us what you've recommended with the hashtag Tripod. That's TRY pod. Spread the word. Well, that's it for this week. Our new host, Francis Lamb, will be here next week, so don't miss a chance to talk to him. In the meantime, let me leave you with this quote from Agatha Christie. It is a curious thought, but it is only when you see people looking ridiculous that you realize just how much you love them. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.